So thank you, Amy, and thank you all for coming. Come on in and have a seat. Come on up to the front. We need people at every table. Y'all are fine back there. So, but if you would come up to the front, it would be good. So I'm going to introduce Jack first, and then he's supposed to introduce me. We've been doing this for 14 years now, and I'll tell a little bit about Jack. We had a long-term member of our church who passed away that lived on Valley Drive named Gloria Horning. And whenever I would visit her, she would tell me that she remembered when Jack and Ann and their very small children moved into the neighborhood. And that was a good while ago. Since that time, they are now grandparents twice, and one very recently. I've told the story before that when I was moving to Iowa, I was in a store in Iowa getting ready for the move, and my cell phone rang, and it was Jack Moline calling to introduce himself. So he introduced himself to me before I ever got here. We have worked together and lived through Presbyterian controversies over divestment. We've done two trips to Israel. We've done about seven or eight Jack and Larry shows. I asked him to be our guest preacher 11 years ago when I hightailed it back to Iowa to get married. We were worshiping in your place at that time. We have shared Passover meals. I have sat in your, is it Sukkoth booth? What's it called? Sukkoth booth in your backyard. I have seen Purim videos in which Jack stars. We have had breakfast at Pizza Iola, which did not exist when we first became friends. Jack has since retired from Agudas Hakim and has been, if we can use this word, reincarnated as the president of the Interfaith Alliance of Washington. It did, right? So you introduce me, then I'm going to give the genesis of the series. We're going to go fast today so you all can get to work.
We are. Listen, everybody knows Larry. I'll just tell you the story of origin you may or may not know. When Larry was growing up in Memphis, he got a tryout with the Yankees at one of their spring training teams, and he was out there in center field, which was his position. Fly ball came, simple fly ball. He dropped it, and he heard a voice call, "Larry Hayward, Jesus Christ," and realized his ball career was over, but he had been summoned to another mission.
You shall worship the Lord in spirit and truth, and if truth's not there, spirit will get you a long way. So the genesis of this series, in his retirement, Jack writes a weekly blog, which is available at jackmoline.com, and he does a weekly column. And for the last couple of years, that column has consisted, I don't want to take this away from you, but I think he first took the third verse of Genesis. So he would have a weekly column on, you know, about, I don't know, 500-600 words, strictly on that verse, you know, Genesis 1:3, Genesis 2:3, Genesis 3:3, and now you're on Exodus 5, the fifth verse of Exodus. And they are many times wonderful, but it's great to see. They really are, and they've sort of, not always, but, you know, it's once a week, so. But they led me to... They've actually led me to change the way I do newsletter articles, but it's cool because he takes one verse at random and writes on it, which is essentially what we're going to be doing in here. That reminded me of in the South we had sword drills in Sunday school. You open up the Bible and put your finger on it. You have to, you know, memorize that verse. Of preach-ins in seminary where we were assigned a text and given 20 minutes to figure out a sermon on it and then go in and preach. And frankly, the way many Christians learn the Bible is through specific verses that they hold near and dear to their heart. So that's kind of what we're going to do. Today's is going to be the text, and then we're going to talk about context next week, how you would expand the verse out to learn more about it from the context. And then the last one will be pretext, which is what we bring to the verse or what we might take away from it. That's my quick version.
Good. Yeah, Larry, you know, when Larry and I have breakfast, sometimes we have business to conduct, but mostly we just schmooze, or that talk in Presbyterian terms. And Larry asked me about how I came up with this idea. Quite honestly, you know, our lectionary is a weekly lectionary, so we read from the beginning of Genesis to the end of Deuteronomy on an annual basis. And the readings are set for each week for the next gazillion years because they follow the Jewish calendar. And everybody who writes any kind of commentary on the Bible writes by the weekly portion. So that's a sumptuous feast if you're starting with Genesis, because there's always something to write about in Genesis. By the time you get to the middle of Leviticus, everybody is trying to find something new to say about the one verse that isn't about ashes and blood and heifers and stuff like that. So I just looked for something different to do, and I randomly picked the third verse of each chapter in Genesis, wrote all the way through, wrote to a couple of friends of mine and said, all right, so after 50 weeks, I'm done with this. What should I do next? And they all wrote back and said, Exodus. So I picked another number, and I will pick another number for Leviticus and another for Numbers, and then I've already decided I'm going to call the fifth one the last of Deuteronomy, and it'll be the last verse in every chapter in Deuteronomy. All right. But as Larry said, you know, once you decide to do something like that and you start on the path, you have to finish it. And so we talked about how it was that I could choose a random verse and find something relevant to say. And although he described correctly text, context and pretext, he described it much more academically than I use it. I either try to extrapolate on the verse itself in some way, I either use it as the context for something I wanted to say anyway, or I use it as the pretext for something I wanted to say anyway, and what pops out is of uneven but occasionally brilliant quality. So we get asked this question every now and then by congregants, parishioners. How do you figure out what you're going to talk about, and then how do you go about doing it? Larry has this wonderful retreat he goes on every winter, the Movable Feast, where he and a group of his colleagues sit and learn together, they study together, and they come up with a whole wealth of material that they're able to use for the rest of the year. I, as a lonely, retired recluse, have no such regular set of conversations with my colleagues, and because I work in an interfaith setting, I always have to check myself before I start writing Jewishly that I'm not writing about something like, you know, the resurrection. So we decided we would just sort of illustrate one of the ways that we can go about this. And here's what we're going to do. Today we're going to do text. You have four texts on the table in front of you. On one side of the sheet is a text from Hebrew Scripture. On the other side of the sheet, actually, a text from Torah. All of my verses are going to be from the five books of Moses, because they're just too much material for me to look through the rest of the Hebrew Bible. And on the other side are New Testament texts. Larry and I are going to illustrate, each of us very briefly, how we might interpret the text this week, the verse in context next week, and the verse as pretext the following week. And then we've given you a second verse from each of the two scriptures, from Torah and from the New Testament. And we're going to give you some time, as groups sitting around this table, to see what message you would come up with with the starting point of the verse you will have. The verses will be different every week, so you can't sort of think ahead looking at these. And we didn't decide on this till this week, so we haven't had much more time than you to think about what we're going to say. But that's what we're going to do.
What else am I supposed to say here?
That's it.
Yeah.
So you start.
Oh, I start.
The Old Testament's first. Right. I do want to welcome all the people from Agudas Akim here today. This is a terrific turnout for guests. So thank you for being here.
So the format is I'm going to talk for just a couple of minutes. I have some notes. And then Larry is going to talk to me about what I said. We'll have a little back and forth. And then we'll switch places. And then it'll be your turn. And I'll tell you what we're going to do when we get there. So if you look at the first of the two verses from Torah, you'll see the one that I'm going to talk about today, speaking in the middle of Leviticus. And when a person, this is Leviticus 5:17, which will not be part of my weekly rotation. And when a person, without knowing it, sins in regard to any of the law's commandments about things not to be done, and then realizes his guilt, he shall be subject to punishment. That's the verse. So, I am a very, very good driver. I'm a very good driver. The last time I was involved in a moving collision was more than 30 years ago. I was living in Danbury, Connecticut, waiting to turn left into the parking lot to visit someone in the hospital, and I was rear-ended. And that's the last time a car I was driving was involved in an accident. And then about 3 weeks ago, I was driving up 12th Street at 9:30 in the morning at about 8 miles an hour, and there were food trucks that were parked in 12th Street and a food truck that was double parked in the lane that I was in. Traveling behind me, I still contend he was behind me, was a Mack truck. And so the traffic was sort of zippering in, and my turn came, and I pulled in front of the Mack truck and felt a push and heard a buzz. It was really that gentle. And we both pulled over, and sure enough, my rear bumper had been damaged. And I was in the first moving accident I had had since I had the excuse that my children were in the back seat distracting me. You know, I filed a claim. So now let's get to the verse. All right? This verse tells us that there are five components to the unintentional sin. First of all, there's the sin. Secondly, the person who committed the sin, who committed whatever the violation was unaware that he or she had committed the sin. At a later point, whether 5 minutes later or a year later, the sinner realizes that the sin was committed. And the fourth, did I say five? It's only four. The fourth is, the ruling is, he is therefore culpable for whatever punishment comes along with it. Right? Now, that he committed the sin that we're going to take as a given, and let's talk for just a minute about what it means that he was unaware that he committed the sin. Right? Either it could have been a ritual practice or a private act that he committed that he was unaware that he had done. So, for example, he accepts the offer of something to eat and consumes it, and at some later point, 5 minutes later or a year later, discovers there was something forbidden in that concoction that he had eaten. It was an unintentional sin. Or he could have done it anonymously and been unaware. Walking down the street, eating a banana, tosses the peel at a garbage can and misses it, falls on the street. Sometime later, someone comes along and slips on the banana peel and injures himself. He is responsible for that transgression, even though he was unaware of it. It could be that he realizes he's committed a sin after an accusation because he was unaware of it at the time. In our society right now, there's a whole cohort of people in this country called men who are realizing that they have likely committed sexual harassment, however innocently, but it doesn't absolve them of that responsibility. Let me tell you, I have been trying to remember my college years, which is not easy, and not because they were a long time ago, but I'm trying to remember my college years and the relationships that I had back then when I was young and hormonal. The fourth possibility is that the facts were unknown to the sinner and later became known. So, for example, you make a contribution to a charity which you believe is a 501c3, and you later discover that it's a 501c4, which is not tax deductible, but you've already taken the deduction on your income taxes. You've been made aware of a transgression that you committed, right? So this is not a situation in which it is not merely a statement by the verse that ignorance of the law is no excuse, but you could continue to get away with it if you didn't tell anybody. The requirement here is that you have the integrity of your commitment to ethics, your commitment to the law, your commitment to observance, to make things whole again by accepting the punishment. The punishment, in this case, you have a translation which says punishment, culpability, responsibility, penalty, whatever it is a technical term in the text for an expiatory sacrifice. And you would see that if you had the next verse, which you do not. But it is also, the punishment is either restitution or fine if damage has occurred to someone else. For example, the banana slipping thing, if you were culpable for making that person slip and break his leg, Torah would hold you responsible for five very contemporary things, disability, embarrassment, medical expenses, etc. So let me say this again. I am a very good driver. All right? But very reluctantly, I'm coming to terms with the possibility that I may have been responsible for this collision because it was my left bumper and his right wheel, and the person who is culpable is the one who is not fully in the lane. And so I simply can't be sure if it was me, I was following traffic, if it was him because he was coming from behind me and so I was not watching him. But in any event, though I sinned unintentionally, I must, as this verse demands, be ready to accept culpability if it turns out I am guilty and pay whatever penalty is necessary.
Okay. So my questions about this, some from reading the verse and some from listening, are is the punishment lesser for not knowing? It doesn't appear to be in here.
The punishment is not lesser
for not knowing
because the punishment is attached to the action, to the intention.
Okay. Is there an exception for people who would not be aware of the law or would not have the ability to know the law?
Those are two different questions.
Yes.
Okay. So, first of all, you remember that when we talk, Mike,
First of all, you have to remember when you talk about Torah and you talk about Torah law. Oh, good. When you talk about Torah, the laws only apply to people who are part of the covenant. So we're talking about Jew on Jew crime here. In that case, the ignorance of the law is not, or the unfamiliarity with the law is not an exempting circumstance. That's the reason the laws are there, is what happens when two people do something and don't know what the resolution is. The resolution is determined as a matter of law. So the fact that they did it without realizing it is not an excuse. The inability to comprehend the consequences of actions, however, is an exempting factor because you cannot be held liable under Torah law if you are unable to comprehend the consequences of your action. And that is derived from a situation in which a child, defined as someone below the age of 13, below the age of majority, if a child commits a crime, that child is not held liable for it because he's not considered to be morally formed yet. So by extension, someone who is a shoteh, which is today we would call them of limited mental capacity, but shoteh literally means an idiot, unfortunately. But someone who's a shoteh as an adult is not required to uphold the law. Do you want to ask me anything else about this verse? All right. Now, remember, we're looking at the plain meaning of the verse and how I might apply it in a homily of some kind. Yes. That's a very good question. So if the perpetrator is not Jewish, this rule does not apply. Let's not say no rule applies, but this rule does not apply. All right. Not the proudest aspect of Jewish life. All right. If the if the victim is not Jewish, it depends on the status of the victim. All right. Now let's talk biblical times, not today. The other guy, the guy in the truck, was definitely not Jewish. I can tell you that. All right. If for no other reason than the way he kept looking at my head when I got out of the car. If the other person is a slave, which was possible in biblical times, there's a different set of consequences, including none, that would pertain depending on the transgression. If he were an idolater, a second set, and if it was somebody from the authorities, it might very well be a third set of requirements. But this transgression, the transgression itself, if it's ritual, if it is a if it's a sacrifice that has to be offered because of something that was done, then it doesn't matter if there was a victim. The sacrifice is incumbent on the Jew for misbehavior. Barry.
Is one purpose of the punishment so to not repeat the behavior?
So that's a great question. The question was, is one purpose of the punishment not to repeat the behavior? The reason I'm not going to answer that is because that's not the pshat. That's not the plain meaning of the text. That's not in the text. The text only tells us what the penalty is. It doesn't tell us the reason. Context and pretext may give us the opportunity to discuss something like that. So come back the next 2 weeks, and you'll find an answer. With a different verse. But, yes. Ah, so this is a great reason to learn Hebrew, all right? No, I'm not kidding. When you talk about the plain meaning of a text, if you're working in translation, you have to go with what the translation is. I'm not sitting here with the Hebrew in front of me, but I can tell you because I looked at it this morning. I just don't remember the specific word. Subject to punishment is definitely an interpretive translation, because the plain translation, which I think is liable, doesn't mean anything to the English speaker. So when King James or his scribes or the Jewish Publication Society, whoever did this translation, came up with this translation, it was to make the verse accessible to English speakers. But the notion of subject to is not contained in the Hebrew original. Great question. All right.
All right. You're up. Oh, I've got one here. So turn your page over. And again, today we're just talking about the text. So we're not talking about anything outside of the words on the page, including any secret knowledge we might have, like who the author would be. This is just the words on the page. So Alexander the coppersmith did me great harm. The Lord will pay him back for his deeds. You also must be aware of him, for he strongly opposed our message.
Beware or aware?
You must also beware. Beware. Okay. Yeah, beware. Watch out. Okay. And again, I'm working from English and not Greek. What I'm going to give you is sort of the way I would study this to write a sermon. And this is richer than some passages are. Okay? So I start by, this is indicative. So it's making a statement, and it's got a kind of a first-person tone to it when we get to our message. Is the speaker male or female? We don't know from the text. Is the speaker young or old? We don't know from the text. The subject of the speaker is Alexander the coppersmith. Our assumption is that a coppersmith works with his hands, with metal, and with fire. What is the relationship of the speaker to Alexander the coppersmith? Is he a family member? Is he a friend? Is he have business with Alexander the coppersmith? Are they a member of the same community, of the same religious community? Are they peers? Is Alexander his boss, or is Alexander his employee? Did harm, or did great harm? What leads the speaker to say Alexander the coppersmith did me great harm versus did me harm? And what's the difference between those? What is the nature of that harm? Is it physical, emotional, mental, psychological, spiritual, or economic, or any of those? To get a little bit away from the text, is this a Me Too moment? Is it a blowing of the whistle on the part of the speaker? Is the speaker speaking to someone who is a superior, or to someone who has power over Alexander the coppersmith, to someone who is equal to Alexander, or to someone who could be a potential victim of Alexander? Is the tone of this verse one of anger, or is it one of reflection and studied wisdom? When did Alexander do the speaker great harm? Was it yesterday, or was it 30 years ago, or sometime in between? That's the first verse. At the end of the first verse, or halfway through, after the word harm, we move to resolution. The resolution in the speaker's mind is that the Lord will pay Alexander the coppersmith back. Not the speaker, not the recipient of the comment, but the Lord. Not civil society, not the court, not the police, not the church, not the synagogue, but the Lord. It leads to the question, has the speaker tried other forms of resolution? Has the speaker gone to court? Has the speaker gone to the police? Has the speaker tried to have a direct conversation with Alexander? It also leads to the question, what leads us to turn a hurt that another has inflicted on us over to the Lord? Has the speaker confronted Alexander, turned Alexandria in? Is it wise of the speaker not to go to Alexander if Alexander is one who holds a glowing hot prong in his hand? You know, is it legitimately dangerous to go to Alexander? Is this conversation, who is Alexander saying this to? I mean, who is the speaker saying it to? Is it pillow talk? Is it a talk at the kitchen table? A talk around the fireplace at home? Is it someone speaking in a classroom? Is it a talk to a physician, to a counselor? Is it a parent speaking to a child, a grandparent speaking to a grandchild? Or is it a child speaking to a parent, or a teacher, or a coach, or a scout leader? And that's not in the text. And notice the Lord will pay him back for his deeds. Notice that it is deeds, plural, and not deed. What's the difference? If someone's hurt us once versus over and over, are the deeds just against the speaker, or are they deeds that are against other people as well? Then the second part of the resolution is, you must also beware of him. And it is beware. and in my good Southern study of the English language, is it you or y'all? I could look that up in the Greek, but I haven't. But what difference does that make? It does make a lot. It could be regional, which is very significant. I've got a note here I can't understand. Is that impacted by the first part? The first part of the resolution is the Lord will pay him back for his deeds. The second part of the resolution is you must be aware of him. Be aware of him. So he's turned the ultimate resolution over to God, but he still feels a need to warn others that Alexander is on the loose. Now, of what must he be aware? The hearer be aware, because Alexander strongly opposed our message. You know, what is our message? Is it our common work together? Is it our family? Is it what? Again, we just have the text here. Is this personal revenge on the part of the speaker? Is it a sense of seeking justice? Is it a sense of protecting others? Or all three? Is our message that of the church or the synagogue, the business, the school, the political party, the group, or the family member? He uses our, so it's some community that he's seeking to protect. I'm almost done here. And that's context, that's pretext, so I'm not going to do this. The questions that, there are three other questions that it raises for me, and then I'll stop. I think it asks us, in a situation where we have been wronged, when do we exact personal justice and resolution? When do we seek justice for ourselves? Which is an interesting question for Christians, but that's not in the text. Versus, when do we seek to protect the community? And if we do the first, if we seek justice for ourselves, is that sufficient? And if the first fails, if we do not get justice for ourselves, are we still obligated to seek to protect the community? And third, what if all this were on social media?
Done.
So this is a great illustration of still laboring in the vineyards of the Lord, because you have a lot of time to think about all these questions and squeezing it in around a full-time job that, you know, doesn't allow you all this reflection. Wow, Larry, I'm very impressed. So I know that you're one of these guys that writes like 4, 5, 8, 12 versions of a sermon before you deliver it. Having been through all of these questions, if you were going to present a message to your folks and you were not going to take the time to go through the process by which you arrived at it, what is the plain meaning of this text that you would commend to them?
I would say two. One,
use your mic.
I would say two plain meanings of the text. One of the plain meanings of the text is vengeance belongs to the Lord. Okay. The second plain meaning of the text is you need to protect the community. You have an obligation to protect the community.
Even when you don't get your personal satisfaction.
Yes, even when you don't get your personal satisfaction. You need to protect the community even when... Is it on now? Okay. You need to... You. vengeance belongs to the Lord. You need to protect your, you need to protect the community.
Okay, so good, and that you know, you don't need anybody to draw you all a picture as to where that might apply in society today. You actually may need someone to draw you a picture as to where it doesn't apply in society today. But all of this other stuff is legit. How do you decide that it's not relevant to a message that you're going to present?
Well, you're asking a homiletic question, which is also not in the text.
But all this stuff is plain meaning, all right?
Right, all this is plain meaning.
All right, so if, you know, if the question is it being expressed in wisdom or anger, that may not wind up being part of your message.
Correct.
But it doesn't mean it's not an essential part of understanding the text.
Correct.
And so it, whether you're giving a sermon or one of you is having a conversation with a friend and pulls out a biblical verse, which is something I know we do all the time,
right?
And or you're simply asked to reflect on this. By what process would you define if something is relevant? And I'll give you my excuse here is that being the egotistical maniac that I am, I look for something that speaks to me, as you heard in what I presented, and said, you know, what experience have I had? What thoughts have I been going through that this verse in its plain meaning is speaking to me in a context that I can relate to others? How do you make the decision?
I would say two things. One is you know, in writing a sermon, or if I've got 20 minutes, which is what I've got, often it'll be in the writing. It's what bubbles up to the top. But often that is because it speaks to me, because I think the things we most are able to convey to a congregation are things that mean something to us.
Yeah.
I would also say there are times when a text like this has a clear perceived relevance on my part to the audience, you know, to the congregation. So you might go with it on that.
Good. Who's got questions for Larry before we put you all to work?
In your discussion, you keep using the term plain meaning.
Yeah.
I mean, why should we assume that there is a plain meaning to a text? I mean, I think one of the principles we usually hear about biblical interpretation is that, you know, the Bible interprets itself, and it's not appropriate to look at verses purely in isolation.
Yeah. Ooh, I have a great answer for that. So you're all familiar with the word paradise. It comes from a Hebrew word that comes from the Persian, pardes. Our sages 2,000 years ago posited that every verse in the Bible has a meaning that is defined by pardes. The P in pardes stands for pshat, which is the simple, plain meaning of the text, just what it means literally. The R stands for remez, which means something that is hinted at, which is context. The D sound stands for drash, which is interpretive, which is contextual. And the S sound at the end of paradise, pardes, is for sod, which means secret or the mystical meaning of the text. So there's an acknowledgement in the beginning that anytime you have a text placed in front of you, you're looking at layers of meaning. But we have to engage with one or another of them at any given moment. I can't think both literally and mystically simultaneously and have a comprehensible thought. So it is worth trying to pull out those meanings when you're sharing in any way, whether you're sharing in an internal dialogue or you're sharing in a very public or in a private setting or in a dialogic setting when you're studying with someone. It's worth pulling those things out so that you can appreciate the texture and variety of the meanings that come with the text. What we're doing in these 3 weeks is something that Larry or I would do if we were sitting to write a sermon in a matter of, well, you know, 6 or 8 hours or 20 minutes. So we would try to consider all of those meanings.
That's not the length of my sermons. That's the prep time.
Prep time. I never speak for as short as you do. I figure if you spend less time talking than you spent thinking. You haven't thought enough.
And Paul, I would answer too that both in Judaism and in certain strands of Christianity, certainly literalism and plain meaning are often held to be the truth,
right,
and the only truth. And that's not something in either of our traditions that we believe. And that's why we're doing three segments. In subsequent segments, you'll see, if we were doing this verse, you would see the context, who the writer is, and then pretext is more interpretation. But there is a hidden assumption in our traditions that a verse in the Bible has one meaning and only one meaning, and that that's the truth, and that that's what you ought to go by. I'm not doing that quite justice, but I think that's deeply embedded in a tradition in ways we don't even realize. And sometimes you can go with just the words, as I have, and it can be really rich. Sometimes you can go with just the words, and it can lead you astray, as you know.
Yeah, if we'd chosen the verse, "You shall not murder," everybody has a sense of what the plain meaning of that is. All right, but to use Larry's model, who the "you" is and what constitutes murder is the subject of a good deal of deliberation and discussion, yeah, in every legal system that has applied that very simple verse.
I think you made a really good point, an observation, and it certainly could. I mean, Alexander may have ripped off the writer, you know, who contracted with him to make a new horseshoe for his horse. He also may be somebody that is opposing the writer's message in whatever that message is, and that's what he's warning against. It's possible that it's two sort of separate things. It's also possible that it's not.
And here's a good reason to put a check on yourself when you read a verse like this. You stated it very accurately. You said, "When I read this verse, I hear," right? Which is the hazard that everybody has when they read anything, is that they bring their own experience, like having a traffic accident, to the reading of a biblical verse. That may very well be the plain meaning of the text, but it isn't necessarily so. And so you have to be able to get past your own perceptions, your own readings. The questions that you raise here, Larry, are amazing. I mean, even if I read the verse this closely, I would not have thought of all of these things.
Well, and there's
hats
more,
off to
I'm
you.
Sure. So thanks.
Yep.
So.
You're making a great segue.
Yeah.
No, you're making a great segue, because now that's exactly what we're going to do.
Right. So y'all are going to do.
Right.
Right.
Right. We've done it.
We
did our work already. You know, when we do these sessions, the first conversation we have is, what can we do that will be the least amount of work for us? So, all right. So now you have a second verse from both Torah and Christian scripture in front of you in the New Testament, and as a group,
we haven't
until quarter of until.
I've got to leave a quarter of.
Okay.
They can go.
So we'll stay a little bit later if we have to. We're going to give you 5 minutes. You can choose either verse. It doesn't matter. We're going to give you 5 minutes to talk at the table to try to ferret out what the plain meaning of either of those verses is, and then we're going to call on somebody, and you can choose that person however you want, or we will pick them randomly, to tell us what first of all, which verse you're talking about so there's no confusion, and secondly, what the plain meaning of that verse is as far as you're concerned. So we're going to give you 5 minutes to talk about it. We'll go around the room and hear from everybody else, and those of you who want to stay, after Larry goes, we'll do a second round with the other verse, the one that you didn't choose the first time around. So go.
See, they come up with things that either of us can use, you know?
No socializing. Get to work.
So I don't have to do that after I leave.
Right.
What time is it? Did you mean during the service?
Yeah.
I got to take somebody to lunch at downtown. Yeah, I actually did see that.
Yeah.
I didn't look at the time. You know, because it's...
All right, you just have 2 minutes left.
So next time we'll get right to it. I mean, we'll have more time.
We're doing fine.
This is the easy one anyway.
Yeah.
This is the one where you have to hold yourself back. The other one is where you have to hold yourself back. That's the one. And we're doing it in And how is this book? I presume you read it.
I know.
I know. Okay, I only do my phone myself. Why spend so much time on Zoom? Amy called this morning to tell me that a lot of people are interested in your presentation on the comments. And then said, well, let me ask you, are you going to the congressional hearing about the clause in the Constitution?
All right, wrap it up. Get ready with your message. All right, I'm looking at tables where people have stopped talking, and we're going to start with the one all the way in the back there because nobody's saying nothing. Tell us what you got. First of all, which verse are you using, Timothy or Leviticus? Oh, I'm sorry. Exodus or Matthew? Leviticus or Exodus? You're choosing Exodus? Go for it. Okay. Very nice. Can I ask, where did you get "don't condescend"? Okay, where did you get "don't condescend"? Good. Just curious. All right, who's next? Anybody want to volunteer now that you won't be the first? Go for it. Good.
Stand up. It'd be better if you still...
Exodus and Matthew, right. Yep. All right. What did you do with shake the dust from your feet? Good. Thank you.
Come on. Larry's got to go to work. Somebody.
Go ahead.
Okay. We did Exodus, and we spent a lot of time talking about and what poor may mean. Our Hebrew scholar said it probably refers to money, literally. But we also talked about the fact it might be reputation, it might be their spirit, it might be their position as the victim in this. And so that even if they don't have money or they are the victim, or then we had to go back to what deference means. We had only a second. So we decided it means favoritism. You don't show favoritism just because the person is either doesn't have money or is the victim or is pitiful. That should not be part of justice.
Very nice. That you struggled with the understanding of poor is an important part of this as well. Because a quick, facile reading of this might very well say, well, it's just that he doesn't have any change in his pocket. But it could be that poor here is defined in a different way. An important thing to look at. Great. Come on, you know it's coming around to you sometime. You might as well do it now. Good.
Stand up. It's better if you stand up.
So we again looked at the Exodus one and deference. We were having a discussion about that also, what that meant. Was it that you just let him go first, you know, or don't let him go first. Just treat him like everybody else. And then before, again, we looked at that as well. Was it economic? Was it poor condition? Was it spiritual? Whatever it was. And then for dispute, we also looked at the word dispute. Was it an economic dispute? Was it a legal dispute? What was involved was what the dispute was about. And I don't think we really, did we come to a resolution on it? I think we were busy trying to figure out which context we were looking at. And I don't know, does anybody else want to say anything?
I just came to the conclusion that justice is blind. Treat everybody equally.
So, no question that that is a plain meaning of the text. But the fact that you struggled with all of these terms, you left one out, the you. Who's the you in the plain meaning? Are you a judge? Are you just somebody on the street? Are you trying to resolve a business dispute with someone? You know, should I be worried about this guy driving the truck because the likelihood is that I'm in a better financial position than he is? So what looks like a plain meaning when you read it first, on further reflection, may not be so plain. So, good, terrific. Who else?
Some of the verses are, the verses on side A are in common and held as scripture by both the members of both congregations, and the verses on side B are held as part of scripture by one congregation, but regarded as perhaps, I suppose, sort of interesting thoughts by the other, I'm not sure how they characterize.
Wisdom. Let's just use wisdom.
Did you wrestle at all with the structure of the conversation?
No.
I chose the New Testament. You chose all.
Yeah, we suggested to each other that to avoid landing in the same kind of material that I look toward the beginning and he looked toward the end, and but. I will come back to that. I want to hear from everybody. Yeah. Yeah, I will come back to that, I promise, before you all leave. But Larry has to leave, so I'd love to hear from everybody else. All right. We're staying for another 5 minutes, 6 minutes, because 5 minutes for you all, and then I'll tell you a one-minute story. Go, please. Very interesting. And not that I disagree with that, but how do you get that from this text? So I'm going to make a suggestion only because we don't have a lot of time. Sometimes the plain meaning of a text, or what appears to us to be the plain meaning of the text, is uncomfortable for us within the set of values that we have on other things. All right? So the poor man who steals a loaf of bread to feed his family versus the wealthy kid who snatches something off of a fruit stand just because he can get away with it strike us as being two different situations, even though if we applied this verse literally, the punishment would be the same. So it's another thing when you look at a plain meaning that you have to guard against is bringing your own context, which is what we'll talk about next week, or a pretext that you're looking to discuss, bringing that with you. I think we haven't heard from your table, right?
Yeah.
I'll tee it up. So we did Matthew, and just plainly, it could be my way or the highway.
My way or the highway. Good.
Words.
saying they don't take retribution in these circumstances, but just say, with this as Doug said, and the shake off the dust, we had some discussion of what the context might be, so we viewed off the without context. It sounds sort of like a good gesture.
Good, right. Understanding what that phrase means in the context of everything is important. You all remember when Nixon went to Egypt during his presidency, and as his train rode through the countryside, people were waving their shoes at him. All right. If you didn't know what that was, you would think, it's some honorific thing. But in that culture, showing someone the bottom of your shoe is not a sign of respect. So knowing what shake the dust off means is important. And we don't. We don't. It's another one of those things. Well, I mean, I don't here. But we don't in just reading this verse. All right, I think you guys are the last table. Is that right?
I'll try to talk to them.
Okay.
If you're talking to somebody and they won't listen, their mind's made up.
Yeah, please stand up so people can...
And let it go.
If you're talking to somebody and they won't listen, forget about it. Leave and let go.
Somebody doesn't understand me or believe what I'm saying, that just means it's going to take me more time to get them to agree with me.
He's a Jehovah's Witness.
Very nice. This phrase, shake the dust off your shoes, always struck me as an arrival idiom as opposed to a departure idiom. So it's a very curious thing. All right. Here's the quick answer to the question about the metastructure. I'll tell you a great story about Senator Kaine, Tim Kaine. As part of Faith and Politics, he participates in a group that I co-lead every other Wednesday when he's there. And we were talking about the role that public officials sometimes have to play that overlaps with the role that pastors have to play, and that he found himself far too often when he was governor, I guess senator also, comforting people who had been the victims of tragedy. And I actually think he was talking about once when he was mayor of Richmond, he went to visit a woman who had lost a child to gun violence and didn't know what to say to her, and said to her, I don't have any words that can comfort you, but at least you know you have a God who knows what it means to lose a child. My breath was taken away by that statement. All right? It is a statement that never would have arisen in my consciousness because it's not my tradition. And yet, because he understood where she was, he was able to use that phrase in comfort to her, and it was a comfort to her. All right, now, God forbid I should ever find myself in a situation of comforting someone who has lost a child, though it has happened, not since I've heard Tim speak about this. But if that individual were indeed a faithful Christian, I would not hesitate to take that as something that sounded like a piece of wisdom to me, but would sound theologically profound to my listener and use it. So it doesn't matter to me where the verse comes from. In fact, one of the things we kicked around, except we've done it before, was using each other's text to do the plain meaning. But we did that one already, so we figured we'd make you work instead of us. So please come back next week. We're going to do context, and then the week after we'll talk about pretext.